Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Julie Ellenbecker, president of Ellenbecker Investment Group. EIG believes in the importance of education, allowing people to gain the knowledge to feel confident in their personal decisions. This show highlights the unique financial perspectives of its many guests, including economists, attorneys, book authors, business owners, and tax professionals. It is provided for general information purposes only and does not consider your particular investment objectives or financial situation and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for you. Before acting on information on this show, strongly consider seeking advice from your own financial advisor. The opinions expressed on Money Sense do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Ellenbecker Investment Group employees and leaders. Please enjoy today's show.
Money Sense is brought to you by Ellenbecker Investment Group, four-time recipient of the Better Business Bureau Torch Award for business ethics and integrity. Ellenbecker Investment Group is the only Wisconsin investment company to receive this prestigious award more than once by providing exceptional planning and extraordinary service each and every day. Go to ellenbecker.com and listen to Money Sense Saturdays at 2 and Sundays at noon.
Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Jamie Williams, wealth advisor for the Ellenbecker Investment Group. Ellenbecker Investment Group is located in Pewaukee, just north of I-94, between 164 and Highway F, in Ridgeview Corporate Park, and also in the village of Whitefish Bay in the Equitable Bank Building across from Winkies. We also service clients in Bonita Springs, Florida. Visit ellenbecker.com for more details. My guest today is Barry Mendelson, CEO of Capital Market Consultants. Barry and his team are longtime friends of EIG, and they're based here in Milwaukee. Barry's been on Money Sense numerous times, and we want to welcome you back to the show today, Barry.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Excellent. So it's great to have you back. I know that you've been on with Karen and other team members of EIG over the years, and you know, I'm really excited about today's discussion around investment research. We're going to talk about the importance of investment research, share some thoughts on that, and you know, also why it's important to approach the investment holdings in your portfolio, as well as how to gain some level of understanding in terms of investment behavior in these types of investments and why it's critical. But before we jump in, Barry, I would like for you certainly to share a little bit about your company. And you know, I'm also interested to hear how you got started in this business.
Sure. I've been in the financial service business for over 40 years. And the first part of my career, I was a financial advisor, just like yourself, for about a decade. And that gave me a real appreciation for working with households and working with consumers, retail consumers. The second part of my career, which was another about a 10-year period of time, I was working in a corporate environment where I was helping to build investment advisory programs for those companies. Locally, I did that with Robert Baird for 4 or 5 years. And then following that period of time in the early 2000s, I decided that there were a lot of different firms, different types of firms, from accounting to legal to broker-dealers to banks that were getting into this wealth advisory business. And I thought, why not start a business that services those types of organizations, and because there was a sort of a lack of personnel, there was a lack of experience in those industries for this wealth advisory business, and I'd already had a decade's worth of experience, and I thought I could bring that to bear and not be limited by the firm I was working for, but I could be working with accounting firms and law firms and firms like yourself and multifamily offices and regional banks, which is exactly the kind of clientele we have today.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you for sharing. So headquartered here in Milwaukee, you and your team spent a lot of time obviously poring over data, a lot of information relative to portfolio construction, a lot of great things that go into that.
A lot of data. It's very data-centric. In fact, my wife said to me, facetiously, if I'd known you were this big a nerd, I wouldn't have married you in the first place.
Oh, that's great. Well, I kind of share a little bit of a fondness for that myself as well. When I started in this business, I had no exposure to the actual investment allocation, in my financial career. I was in banking. I was in commercial lending and private banking. And then about 20 years ago, decided to learn about investing and what goes into building good quality portfolios. And so that's where I think that, you know, being in this business, you could kind of take it in a lot of different directions in terms of where you want to focus. As far as Ellenbecker is concerned, you know, we focus on wealth management for the individual and certainly have to rely on others to help us determine which direction and what's best for our clients. So thank you for that. In terms of the current landscape, I know there's so much going on right now with the end of the first quarter. Here we are in the beginning of April 2024. And, you know, kind of setting the landscape or the stage for, you know, where we are going into the middle part of this year, I just thought it would be nice to kind of reflect a little bit on where we've been, okay? And so I just kind of taking it back to the last recession, 2008, 2009, I remember it well. Commercial loan, you know, defaults were happening, bank, you know, downgrades, all of those things were really kind of a driver for what ended up to be a pretty tough go in the markets at the end of that decade. We've seen a great recovery occur. 2022 chimes familiar with some of what we saw in 08-09, just from the standpoint of the downturn in the market. The S&P 500, I know, was down like 34% at one point in 22. The Barclays Ag, you know, bond index was down. And then we had last year, which, you know, the S&P finished up something like north of 24%-ish maybe. And then yields are up, interest rates. So many different things going on. So here we are now. We're, what, you know, 12, 13 weeks into the new year, and the S&P and NASDAQ are up both plus 10% year to date. I'm just curious, like, what are your thoughts? Have you seen this kind of before? Have you seen this story unfold before?
I don't know if I've seen this exact story unfold before, but I think the market is the market in some important ways is hooked up with the economy, because at the end of the day, corporate stock prices have some relationship to corporate profits. And if the economy is doing poorly, or if the economy is doing well, that's ultimately going to be reflected in per share earnings mm-hmm. of companies. And if the economy is headed more in a southerly direction rather than a northerly direction, investors' sentiment and enthusiasm for stocks will tend to wane. Mm-hmm. And if the reverse is happening, and we're coming out of weaker economic times or a recession or a mild recession, and corporate earnings growth is on the rise, investors get very enthusiastic about right. that. What's been happening over the last year or so is that the stock market has been running, or I should say certain parts of the stock market, particularly a handful of technology-driven technology stocks that are often referred to as the Magnificent Seven, mm-hmm, sure. Have been running away with the market, and a good chunk of the performance of the market has been restricted to just those handful of stocks. Those stocks have had tremendous earnings. The question is, does the value of those stocks, the price you have to pay to own those stocks at this stage of the game, is it justified by the earnings which they are producing and the growth of earnings they're right. going to be producing? So to the extent that they're able to keep up with the market's expectation for how fast they will grow, those stocks can do all right in the future. But if sure. they disappoint, given how stretched the valuations are and how much enthusiasm there is for those stocks, they could come into more difficult times. It's perhaps something you're starting to see already, maybe the early cusp of this.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a look at the NASDAQ index, which is, it's called the NASDAQ 100, 50% or so of the NASDAQ 100 is the Magnificent Seven. It's sort of a proxy for those seven stocks. The NASDAQ 100 underperformed the broader S&P 500 in the first quarter, which means that other stocks which have been more out of favor
sure.
are now starting to gain investors' attention, because they look at the price they have to pay to buy the Magnificent Seven and they say, I don't really want to go there, because if I pay a high price, my return will be lower than what's happened in the past. And so they're looking for less expensively priced stocks. And it appears as though you're starting to see that in the S&P 500.
That is fascinating because there are just so many factors involved in that sector in general. And we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, the capital markets today, your approach, that why it's important to look at investment research and why we own certain things at certain times. But nonetheless, I mean, it's just been an incredible ride we've seen. Somebody that I know referred to last year as kind of an escalator ride down and an elevator ride up. And into the new year here, I think we had, 7 or 8 weeks of just positive growth. So, you know, tying that back into another thing that drew my attention recently was the extremely low amount of volatility we've been seeing in the market. It's just, it's pretty calm out there, generally speaking.
And that's a result of investor enthusiasm. And or the flip side of that coin is for those people who are more cautious about the behavior and the prices of stocks, they would say that enthusiasm is the flip side of that is mm-hmm. complacency.
Right.
And they're not expecting anything to go wrong. And if something does go wrong, they're not ready for it.
Yeah,
and that's when you get elevated volatility very quickly.
That's when people start to have that euphoria effect, right? So
right.
With that, we are here with Barry Mendelson of Capital Market Consultants, friend of EIG. This is Jamie Williams, wealth advisor with Ellenbecker Investment Group. We're going to take a brief break and be right back after these messages. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams with Ellenbecker Investment Group, wealth advisor and certified financial planner. Today, our special guest is Barry Mendelson of Capital Market Consultants, based right here in Milwaukee. Barry and his team are research investment analysts that help a range of different companies determine what the best approach is for their clients and client portfolios. Thank you again, Barry, for joining us. Before the break, we were talking quite a bit about where we've been and kind of where we sit today in terms of the market. And I mean, none of us have that crystal ball. We don't know where things are going. Statistically speaking, I believe that based on a start to a year like this, that typically things do better. But we have a few other things going on this year. We have, you know, the interest rate environment we're in with the Fed. We don't know what exactly is going to unfold there. We have an election later this year that's obviously gonna jitter some folks in terms of what their approach is. But let's kind of talk about one of the important things or themes of our discussion today, which is the research. You know, when we look at investing and deciding how we're going to allocate our portfolios, there are different places we can invest in to create a diversified approach. And obviously, whether it's a younger investor just getting started or someone who's in or at retirement age, where should they be, right? So that's a question that has to be answered with discussions with the wealth advisor, the client. But when it comes to finding the right instruments to invest in, tell me about why that is important and how maybe some thoughts that you approached that.
Investment research is important because investment research is, to some extent, about looking back and analyzing what's happened. But as much as anything else, it's more about looking forward. It's collecting information. It's collecting data. It's running studies. It's stress testing different investment ideas to think about how they might work given an outlook you might have for the future. Again, past performance is no guarantee of future results. And so you're always investing going forward. And in light of that, it's important to have some perspective. It's important to have some point of view on what you think the economy is going to be doing. Harkening back to something I said earlier, the economy is where companies do their business.
Right.
If the economy is not progressing very fast, it's going to be more difficult for companies to do really well. If the economy is accelerating, there's a tailwind behind companies because there's going to be more demand. People will be working and so forth and consuming goods and services. So an important part of what we do and what we're bringing to you guys is having sort of a forward-looking view of what we think the economy is going to look like mm-hmm. and how that might impact interest rates and how that might impact the markets. We also study the market, and we also look at things like how stocks are priced. Are they expensive? Are they cheap? What types of stocks do well? What sectors do well in certain types of economic environments? And you try to marry the two of looking forward with the economy and looking how the where the market stands in terms of its current condition, and you make some decisions as to how you might want to combine assets into a portfolio given a person's tolerance for risk, given a person's need for income, mm-hmm. how you might want to combine that all into a portfolio, a
sure.
living, breathing portfolio.
Most definitely. And I also like to reflect on the idea around, you know, diversifying, right? Because someone said it. I was trying to find the quote somewhere about who said it. There's a lot of famous people that said things about diversification. But the one that sticks out for me is something like diversification won't necessarily help you earn more money, but it may help you lose less, right? Just from a standpoint of downside protection. And as to that point of individual stock ownership, I was, you know, kind of reflect on someone I know that worked for a big bank, you know, that retired from a bank in this area here, a greater Milwaukee, and they had most of their portfolio in this bank stock, individual bank stock, and they hadn't diversified, right? So when that bank failures occurred in 2009, it was not a favorable situation. So, you know, those are some things that are really important for investors to consider. One thing that jumped out at me is that, you know, mutual funds and exchange-traded funds have become really a mainstay, right, for what we use. There's other products too, but that's probably one of the bigger things. There's over 8,000 mutual funds to choose from. And I think something like 3,000 ETFs or something. And I believe 25 years ago, there was like 100 ETFs. So how do you narrow the field down and try to figure out, like, what's the best thing to own, right?
The first thing I would say is we would never use the word best, because best is always changing, mm-hmm. because performance is always changing, and the decisions which go into managing a portfolio have an impact on whether the performance is great or whether the performance is average or whether the performance is poor. So what we're looking for when we help firms like yours to pick investment products and to evaluate investment products is to take a look at how consistent they have been over time.
Sure.
And that's really the sort of the alpha and the omega as far as we're concerned. We like to look at how well the fund has performed or how well the ETF has performed with respect or in comparison to an absolute performance gauge like the S&P 500 or you mentioned the Bloomberg's aggregate index a while ago. And we also like to take a look at how it's performed relative to its peers that manage money in the same kind of way. So we look at the absolute performance. The second thing we look at is the risk that the manager took mm-hmm. to get those returns.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, we look at how that style of investment that the manager is executing day to day, how did it perform in up markets and how did it perform in down markets? We take the three together. We rank and sort all of the managers that are in the same peer group that do the same sort of thing, and then we focus on the ones that have been the most consistent. That's a place
Makes
to start.
Sense.
So you might have hundreds and hundreds of investment products in the same investment category, but you really want to focus on the relative handful, 15 or 20, that have the relative to their peers have the most consistent track record. They're more reliable. And it's not because as people they're more reliable, it's because the system of investing they use has been more reliable. Having said all that, investment styles can go in and out of favor. So while they've been consistent in the past, it doesn't mean that that consistency won't wane for a quarter or two or three. And so you always have to have a long-term perspective on the investment approach the manager is using, how they make decisions, and how that was likely to fare in different sorts of future economic and market environments.
Absolutely. So that's more of the strategic versus tactical type of allocation that
Correct.
We're looking for. We're not looking for quick little, you know, pops here and there. I mean, those are great when they're in our favor, but don't always work out. You know, there's always been this this little thing out there amongst investment professionals that do investing around active and passive, right? Like what's the difference and what's in favor? And I guess from my perspective, well, they're kind of interdependent, but in your view, do you have any thoughts around what types of style or sectors within, I guess, capital market assumptions would fall better for active versus passive?
Well, let me, before getting into a discussion about that, I would say that the most important type of investment to have, whether it's an active or whether it's a passive one, is one that will help you reach your goals.
Sure.
So we're less concerned about whether it's an investment is active or whether it's passive. We're more concerned about whether it's been consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And it has performed consistency relative to other investment options that are out there. So that's number one. If you're talking about an investment manager that has been consistent and has outperformed on a risk-adjusted basis, they've done so because they've taken active risk. They've made certain decisions about what type of stocks to own or bonds to own, how much of them to own, how to concentrate their dry powder in the sectors that they think will give them the best advantage for superior risk-adjusted returns. And so you can be successful in an actively managed approach in all kinds of asset classes mm-hmm. and styles.
Sure.
But having said that, you're more likely to be successful. You're more likely to be successful when you are investing in sectors of the global markets that have a little less research coverage, like small cap stocks. There are many people who follow Tesla. There are many people who follow Nvidia. There are many analysts that follow Microsoft, but there aren't that many that follow Microsoft the way it used to be 40 years ago.
Right, yeah.
And those would be, that's when it was a really small company. So finding stocks early in their history is what a small cap investment manager is all about, and a small cap analyst is looking for those sort of diamonds in the rough that will become the next set of blue chips.
That is fantastic. Yeah, I absolutely. We've been talking to a number of people that owned some of those companies early on, and it's just really fascinating to think about what goes into determining how to approach owning those things in portfolios. So with that, we are here with Barry Mendelson of Capital Market Consultants. I'm Jamie Williams with Ellen Becker Investment Group. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams, Certified Financial Planner and Wealth Advisor at Ellen Becker Investment Group. We're joined here today by Barry Mendelson, who is the CEO of Capital Market Consultants and a friend of EIG, long time running. We're happy to have you back, Barry.
Thank you.
And so before the break, we were talking about a number of things that relate to investing and how to look at diversifying your portfolio and what goes into picking the right funds. And so now, you know, I think where we started to talk about before we went to the break was, you know, different styles of investing. And I always think about the quilt chart that, I don't know, you know, a lot of our listeners may not see this, but if you picture a quilt and then each, you know, vertical line down that quilt represents a year, okay? And there are different boxes like a quilt all the way down from the top to the bottom, and they're different colors. And each one of those represents an asset class. For example, mm-hmm. large cap U.S. equity might be at the top if we're in a normal year, or in a down year, maybe it's at the bottom. We see real estate bouncing around year to year in that quilt. And so this doesn't span, you know, a few years. It typically spans like 20, you know, or more in that quilt chart. It's a great chart. It helps people understand or kind of visualize what a well-diversified portfolio looks like. You know, one of the things that comes up often with clients is investing in international. And, you know, I think you referenced it, global equities before the break. So do you want to maybe just touch on how the importance of that and what it might mean for people to consider?
Sure. Happy to do that. Let me say that just in terms of equities, in terms of stocks, about there is an index not unlike the S&P 500, which is called the MSCI All Country World. And that index essentially comprises 85 or 90% of all the publicly available stocks that can be purchased around the world in any of the world's equity markets, stock markets. About 70% of that index is U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, the U.S. has been only about 55%. But the U.S. stocks, sort of going back to your quilt example, the U.S. stocks have been leading the charge for about the last 15 years. It wasn't always so, and it won't always be so. There will be a what's called a reversion to the mean, and the superior relative returns that U.S. stocks have provided over the last 15 years will sort of, as I've said on many occasions, gravity will take over. And other parts of the world will take the lead over U.S. stocks. No one knows when that will happen. You'll only know in hindsight that will have occurred. But as sure as shooting, it will happen. It's only a matter of when other markets lead the way. In the first 10 years, interestingly, the first 10 years of this century, international outperformed U.S. stocks. In the second 10 years, U.S. outperformed handily international stocks, in large part because you'll remember, going back to the Great Recession that you referred to earlier, the central bank, the Federal Reserve of the U.S., got on the interest rate cutting and stimulating the economy much sooner, about 2 years sooner than other central banks around the world. And so we had about a two-year head start. And so we vastly outperformed international markets in the second decade. And so far in the third decade, 21, 22, 23, 20, and so far in 24, the U.S. has continued to dominate performance around the world, so much so that it has gone from about 55 or 56% of global equity markets to 70%. At some point, that will reverse and probably go back towards the 55%. It'll take a long time to get there, just like it took a long time to get from 55 to 70. But the kinds of things that will get investors thinking more enthusiastically and more favorably towards international investments will be, for example, and in no order of importance, the war in Ukraine resolves itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's been a big problem for the European continent. The U.S. dollar, which has been very strong because of relatively higher interest rates and the relative superior performance of our economy versus other major developed economies around the world, international investors have been investing in U.S. stocks because we have better performance than their local markets.
Right.
But at some point, as interest rates start going down, and then the difference between interest rates overseas and the United States starts to shrink, there'll be sort of a turning, there'll be a turn, and investors will be less apt to pour all of their money into U.S.
Sure.
And they'll be looking at other international markets around the world, whether they are developed markets or whether they are emerging markets.
Absolutely. And I mean, thinking about some of the companies that fall into the large cap international space, I mean, they're names that many people would recognize.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's an immense, you know, marketplace out there.
There's no question about that. So. And we estimate, at least our economist, Dr. Abdur Chowdhury, estimates that we're going to have about 3% global economic growth in 2024, and more than half of it is going to come from emerging market countries.
No kidding. Wow.
So while emerging markets are, in terms of, we talked about expensiveness, American stocks are relatively expensive and sort of doubly so, not only in terms of what they've done in terms of how they've been priced in the past in relationship to themselves, but really cheap in comparison to how international prices are stacked up right now, both for developed markets and emerging markets. They're attractive relative investments, so long as you have a little patience and you have a long enough holding period, you should do pretty well in those international markets.
That's fantastic. Thank you. I thought, you know, at this point, I was thinking about pivoting a little bit to talk about the Fed.
Sure.
And, you know, it's just been such a profound last, 24-month cycle with interest rates and the number of hikes we saw last year and the rationale behind why those hikes occurred. And then here we are today. The Fed chair spoke, I think, last week about, you know, kind of trying to posture where they're at with possible rate cuts in the future. What does that really have in terms of effect on the markets? And I don't know, any general thoughts about where we are in the current interest rate environment?
Sure. When the Fed speaks, investors listen. Professional investors listen. It's very important because it signals to professional investors what it's going to cost for companies to borrow money and run their business. The less expensive the cost of capital is, the higher the profits can be. The more expensive it gets, it's like a headwind against the progress of these companies. So when the Fed speaks, it's really important. So where are we right now? Well, I think it's important to take a look at what the Fed's mission is. The Fed's has two mandates. One of their mandates is, quote unquote, to help the economy achieve full employment. No one really knows exactly what that is, but with a 3.9% unemployment rate in the United States, by almost any definition, we are at full employment right now. No question about that. Number two, their other mandate is to keep inflation under control, and they like to have a target of about 2%. We are very far north of 2%. Interest rates are where they are because the Fed had to raise interest rates to make the cost of capital so high that it slowed down the economy and slowed down demand for goods and services. Because if you have demand that continues to grow, the companies that are producing goods and services can continue to raise prices, sure. And that's what's going to help create more and more inflation. So given where we are right now, you have low unemployment and you have declining inflation. The question really is, what is the incentive for the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates? And the answer is not much.
Yeah.
Because their prescription, which was to reduce the size of their balance sheet and to raise interest rates, is working.
Yeah.
So they've been right in being patient in cutting interest rates. And we think that it's there's a possibility they may not even cut interest rates this year, number mm-hmm. one. Or if they do cut, it may come, there may be one or two, maybe three cuts this year. They're probably, if the labor market continues to be strong and inflation continues to come down, they may not cut anytime soon. And they're probably not going to want to cut too close to the presidential election for fear of looking overtly political.
Right.
And having a really beneficial short-term impact on the stock market. So for now, they're still on hold. We don't expect they're likely to make any changes in the next several months for sure.
Yeah, it's going to be a shift, right, in their cadence toward raising. We've been on a pause cycle. We're going to, at some point when they shift, it's going to be a very interesting time to see what that outlook is.
Right.
And I guess on that end, too, I mean, one of the silver linings here is, you know, fixed income. When I say fixed income, I mean people investing in U.S. treasuries, people investing in bank CDs, things of that nature, at least are in the good seats.
Yeah.
And not, not necessarily people borrowing money today.
Right.
At higher rates.
Bonds actually offer an attractive rate of return. Mm-hmm. When interest rates were ultra low, they weren't any competition for stocks. And there was a saying in the market, there is no alternative to stocks.
That's right.
But now there is an alternative to stocks for sure. And if volatility rises and the stock market pulls back, investors will pour into bonds and that'll help drive interest rates down.
Great insight. Thank you, Barry. We're here with Barry Mendelson of Capital Market Consultants. This is Jamie Williams with Ellen Becker. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams with Ellen Becker Investment Group. We've been joined here today having a great conversation with Barry Mendelson. He is a more or less an expert on the markets and portfolio construction, helping a number of different clients of his over the years with research and a lot of different things. So Barry, you've been having a great conversation here, wealth of knowledge. I really appreciate this. And so before the break, we were talking about the Fed and interest rates and some of the Fed mandates that go into their decision process. And it's funny because I remember years and years ago when Alan Greenspan would talk, it was kind of like people were trying to read between every letter, every word that the man, you know,
reading
said.
Reading the tea leaves.
Yeah. And so that hasn't changed much, right? But, you know, here we are. And so what, in your view, would it take for the Fed to really start changing rates? Because a lot of people are just waiting for rates to come down, and I don't know if that's the right thing to do.
Right. I mean, think about it this way. If the purpose of cutting interest rates by the Fed is to reduce the cost of capital to stimulate the economy, what would have to happen to the economy for interest rates to be cut drastically? The economy would have to crater.
Yeah.
And that's just not happening. So everyone who has this sort of hope that there are going to be a lot of interest rate cuts, I think that's mistaken. And we've been saying that to our clients for about the past 6 or 7 months, that the idea of 6 or 7 or 8 interest rate cuts that the bond market forecasted in the fourth quarter of last year was greatly mistaken, because we said the economy would have to fall apart.
Yeah.
And there's just no prospect that that's going to happen. So we thought there might be 2 or 3 rate cuts this year. And right now the market is thinking there may not be any rate cuts this year, as long as inflation keeps on coming down, as long as the unemployment rate does not go up all that much from here. Or maybe there's 1 or 2 cuts, but it isn't certainly going to be 7 cuts by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, well, it's definitely going to be an interesting next couple, 3 to 4 quarters looking into next year, which is crazy to think 2025 is next year already. That's great. So, you know, one of the things that we had touched on just as we were talking before the show was around the behavioral aspect of understanding your investments, right? Because, you know, when we have volatility and we see a market pullback like we did last fall, we were kind of anticipating something would happen. You know, people probably weren't as spooked as when they saw the S&P go down during COVID of 34%. But, you know, there's still mindset around that. So tell me, in your view, why it's really important to understand the way that certain investments behave based on either interest rates or markets.
Well, I think it's important because understanding how a particular type of investment or investment style is likely to perform in different market environments is sort of a crucial, it's a crucial building block for advisors to build portfolios that have the sort of behavior that an individual investor can tolerate.
Right.
So I think the purpose of understanding the behavior is to help an advisor tailor a portfolio to the personality and to the needs and to the sort of emotional experience with investments that an individual household has.
Sure.
So it's another way of saying two investments might appear to be in the same investment category, but the approach to investing in that category could be drastically different. One might be much more conservative, one might be much more aggressive. And knowing which one's most appropriate for an individual investor is what we help our clients understand, so they know how to apply the investment to the particular situation.
Most definitely. And we touched on it earlier, whether you're a 30-year-old or a 60-year-old, it's going to be different. Some of the investments might be similar, but the concentration or the allocated percentage might be different in the portfolio. Or if someone has more appetite for risk than the other.
Right. Yeah. Right. And that's, you really hit on why understanding the behavior of investments is important, so that it can be tailored for the age and the circumstances and the risk tolerance of each individual household investor.
Yep. And it's all really about timeline. You know, how long are we planning on being on this road? And that is a large part of what we try to help clients understand here through the planning. We use, you know, tools. I use a pencil and paper often in my HP 10B2 calculator to try to figure out cash flow. But what is needed? What is the required amount of return a client needs? What do they need for their spending, especially when they enter retirement? And, you know, with that, you know, I think we've covered so much today, Barry. I can't wait to have you back on the show at some point.
Just look forward to it.
Kind of, you know, cover some more items we didn't get to today. But before we wrap up, I did want to share that we are going to host an event that our listeners are eligible to come and attend. And the idea is it's a retirement readiness event that we are going to host here at our Ellen Becker Investment Office in Pewaukee. It's actually on the corner of Waukesha, Pewaukee on Ridgeview Parkway. And that event is going to happen on Thursday, April 18th. It's from 5:30 to 7 p.m. We are going to be joined by one of our another friend of EIG, Jeremy Ellis of Campbell Newman Asset Management. Jeremy's a chartered financial analyst, and he is going to give us a market update, talk about different forms of investing, themes. We touched on AI earlier. We'll probably touch on the election. There's going to be a lot of great information there. But also, in the latter part of our meeting, we're going to really dive into retirement planning and things that people should be considering, whether they're a year away from retirement, 5 years away from retirement, a decade or more. And so if you're interested in attending our Ellen Becker Retirement Readiness event, please reach out to us. You could call our office at 262-691-3200. You could go out on our website, which is www.ellenbecker.com. And, we'd certainly love to have you. This is open to not only our clients of Ellen Becker, but also anyone who wants to attend. And also my colleague Ryan Lundeen and I will be presenting on the retirement piece. So with that, we really appreciate that. Again, Barry, thank you. I do want to share also that Money Sense airs on Saturdays from 2 to 3 p.m. and on Sundays from 12 to 1. If you like today's show and want to learn more, again, here's our website, www.ellenbecker.com, or give us a call at 262-691-3200. As always, I hope that we've made a difference in your personal and financial well-being through our discussions today. We remember, before we plan, before we advise, before we invest, we always listen. Thank you so much. And again, thank you, Barry, for joining us today.
My pleasure.